Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck Knicks, what the fucking avians, what the fucking ucks? Because I am close to Canada. This is Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. Welcome to it. Today on the show, independent filmmaker Joe Swanberg, the amazing Joe Swanberg, who I couldn't be more excited to have on the show. His recent films include Drinking Buddies and Happy Christmas. That one with Anna Kendrick and Lena Dunham, I thought it was a stunning movie. I've watched several of his movies, and I love them all. This is true independent filmmaking at truly a low budget. And this guy does whatever he wants, and he's got a great sense of cinema and a great sense of aesthetic as an artist. He shot his last film on 16mm film as a choice. Love it. Love him. Great conversation. Those movies that I mentioned are available on Netflix, but Joe Swanberg and I will talk shortly. I know it sounds a little different. I am currently sitting at the window in a hotel room in Rochester, New York. I'm at a Holiday Inn Express, classy. I'm overlooking a bank. It's Saturday, so that bank is closed. There's a parking lot. I'm sort of in a, not really a strip mall situation, but it is a more, I don't even if it's an industrial situation, but it's certainly, I'm sitting here sort of catty corner to a small mall with a Red Robin. There's a mobile gas station with a Dunkin' Donuts within it just across the street. And as you know, have not been drinking coffee lately, but when in the East, I will do as Easterners do. I will drink the Dunkin' Donuts coffee. And that combined with Sudafed, the good kind that you get behind the counter. So the Dunkin' Donuts and the Sudafedrin have given me somewhat of a crack-like buzz without all the sweating and bad smells. I don't consider this a relapse in any way. I do have a horrendous cold, and I am entitled to caffeine as an American. So that's what I'm doing. I'm wearing sunglasses in my room, looking outside at the clouds breaking apart. It's very exciting to be in Rochester or upstate New York at this time where the people are coming out of their caves for the first time in 4 months. I am very happy I do not live in a part of the country where seasonally you are pushed to the limit and you may kill yourself or your family. Those things are thought of, and those things become options when winter is as oppressive as it has been for much of the East Coast this year. My heart goes out to them. I am empathetic, but I am glad I'm here. Like, the sun is shining in and there's still some snow thawing, so I'm getting a little taste of winter, just enough. But I do miss the winter. I actually miss digging my car out of the snow. I miss fighting the authorities because you're not allowed to park on the street during a snow emergency, but yet your car is buried and you have to unearth it. You have to unbury it. You have to find your car within the snowbank to try to move it so you don't get cited for being part of the snow emergency, although being parked there is illegal. The little things I miss about the East Coast. So I'm doing warm-up shows, though they are not booked as that. I'm just booked here at the club, at The Comedy Club. The proprietor here, Mark, is tremendously proud of his club. This is a genuine comedy club, folks, up here in Rochester. It is a box of a room, not much on the wall, and it is spectacular. It's the raw goods. It's the real deal. And Mark Eppolito, the dude that manages the place, is very proud of it. A lot of guys and women come up here to do the stand-up, and it's got sort of a reputation as being a stand-up comedy room. And there aren't that many in the country anymore, you know, when you have corporate-run comedy clubs to sort of play a real gritty comedy club. You know, it's appreciated. It's a great room, and the guy runs a great room. And we had great shows last night. We're doing the shows tonight.
But I'm just here. I'm just here in Rochester. And I'll be honest with you. I have never been in a part of the country where I have no compulsion whatsoever to the regional cuisine. Like, usually I look at it as an excuse to eat badly whenever I'm in a part of any part of the country that offers up anything unique. But really, the only thing they have up here that they're proud of, I mean, I'm not in Buffalo, I'm in Rochester. So what you have here are these things called garbage plates. And I think I might have discussed them. There's some sort of holdover from the Depression era, but it's just a plate of horrendous food. And even when people, even local people, like, yeah, there's this place called Nick Tahoe Hots. And for some reason, I think it has the Hots name has something to do maybe with the hot dogs or links or whatever. But every restaurant, every other greasy spoon in this area has the word Hots on it. There's Empire Hots, there's Joe's Hots, there's Frank Hots, there's Jimmy's Hots, and whatever. It's all Hots. But the garbage plate, I'll just read directly from Wiki and then sort of go into what I experienced last night. The garbage plate is a combination of two selections of cheeseburger, hamburger, red hots, white hots, Italian sausage, chicken tender, fish, fried ham, grilled cheese, or eggs, and two sides of either home fries, french fries, baked beans, or macaroni salad. On top of that are options of mustard, ladled on, onions, ladled on, or a proprietary hot sauce with spices and slowly simmered ground beef. So it's pulverized ground beef made viscous into a sauce with spices in it that they dump over, and they sort of throw a piece of bread on the side. Now, did any of that sound good to you? I mean, it sounds good if you want, maybe if you're you haven't eaten in days, or food is sparse, or if you're completely shit-faced and you just need to carb the fuck out. But people, I was sitting with Mark and a few of the people that work at the club last night because I wanted to get something to eat. And they're like, you get a plate, get a garbage plate over at whatever Hots. And they're trying to explain to me what a garbage plate is, because you sort of have your own plate. When you grow up here, you know what you want. Either you get the hamburger patties, or you get the links, and you get the max out, and the baked beans that are served cold, and the potatoes, the home fries, and just ladle on these simmered onions, ladle on the mustard, ladle on that fucking hot sauce. And they're describing it to me, and I'm like, there's no part of me that is going to eat that. Where's the art in it? It's not like barbecue. It's just like, it's just shit food stacked up and then covered with goo. And I just couldn't deal with it. And then all of them were like, and you're going to get diarrhea. There's like, that's just part of it. That's part of the experience. Like, you'll eat this, you'll have the shits tomorrow. But, you know, and I'm like, then why do you eat it? Like, well, for us, for me, one guy says it's worth it. It's worth it to eat that. So you grow up with something. There's no end to what you'll put up with coming out of your ass just to justify that nostalgia, that comfort of eating just a plate of shit that you grew up with. Now, I don't want to be condescending. I don't want to be rude to people who enjoy a nice garbage plate. Look, I'm sure this, but this is the type of food where it's like, there is no high end. There's no one that's like, there's no gourmet garbage plate. Do you know what I'm saying? But who knows? You know, tonight, my entire attitude may change. I may be, you know, coming at you next Thursday with a celebration of garbage plates. And who knows? Who knows? It's all possible. I tell you, man, every time I've been to New York, the last five or six times, it's just been shit weather. And I all I'm looking forward to is I'm going to New York, and all I'm looking forward to is taking a walk four blocks of Veselka and having a bowl of hot borscht like an old Jew. That's what I do when I go to New York. I'm like, I need to go someplace where I'm comfortable, where I have some comfort food. I don't even want to go to the Comedy Cellar. I don't even want to do anything. I'm going to go. I got some meetings I got to do, and I'm going to have these four shows here. What do I got to go bust my ass for and, you know, go do a 15-minute set in New York for? I could. Does that mean that I'm getting old? Does that mean I don't give a shit anymore? Folks, let me be honest with you. I don't know what the magic number is, but I'm telling you, man, if I hit it, if I hit the magic number, if I win the lottery, or I hit the magic number of fuck you money, I'm not one of these people that's going to hang around and keep coming back to prove that I still got whatever it is that I have. If I hit the magic number, or I make it to fuck you money land, I'm going to take a trip, perhaps forever. I have this fantasy where I just throw my phone into the river, whatever river, perhaps the ocean, just throw my computer away and just, you know, walk off and just like park my car along the side of the road and have a bag with a few legal pads and a couple of the pens I like, and I just head out. Perhaps I should bring some supplies, because I imagine I'd be abandoning my house as well. Perhaps maybe a sleeping bag and a tent that accommodates one or two people. And I'm maybe one of those little burners where I can boil water on and make soup. And I'll just have that and the knowledge that I have some money saved, and that's what I'll do. I'll be a hobo just by virtue of the fact that I have no idea what to do with myself, but I know I don't want to do anything anymore. Is there any shame in that? Don't freak out. It's not happening tomorrow. That was just a fantasy. Isn't that pathetic? That's a fantasy. Is this like walking away from everything that defines a responsible life and just having a traveling kerosene burner or a little Sterno burner that I can make some soup in, and one of those ridiculous pots that you can snap shut and eat out of and also cook in. That's my big fantasy. How can anyone get in touch with Mark Maron? I don't know. You better check the trails. Look at the little books where you sign in on the trails. I would freak out day one or two. As soon as I saw an animal bigger than me, that trip would be over. So I did the Brother Wheeze show up here, you know. Brother Wheeze is one of the powerful dinosaurs of morning drive time radio, going back a couple of decades, maybe almost three decades. One of the originals, the Brother Wheeze show. And I'd never gone in and did the one-on-one with Wheeze, and he's a classic, man. Classic radio dude. He's got the pictures from all the different times of him, you know, all the different eras. You know, he's got to be in his 60s. But he's got those pictures of when, you know, partying was fun and hanging out with Joe Walsh and Kennison and my buddy Jimmy Schubert. You kind of, it's weird when you know the old demons, the old warriors, the guys that lived it who are still around, and you get into that conversation with them. It's like, oh yeah, that dude, is he all right? Is that guy still alive? Oh, he didn't make it, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that back in the day shit. It's getting more intense as you get older. People are dropping, you know. But Wheeze is still alive, and I'd never met him before, and that was a good time. It was a good time. All right, so let's. I really enjoy talking to this guy, Joe Swanberg. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. I just found him to be a very earnest, very smart, very unaffected guy that does exactly what he wants to with the medium he has chosen. Why would I find that so compelling? I guess there's a similarity, you know. But I like his movies. I mean, there's a lot of movies that are called independent movies, but this guy really does independent movies, and he does them with a sort of courageous aesthetic. Like, he takes chances, and he kind of pushes the medium a little bit, and he's very smart about it. And he's the dude who's making the choices, and it was just great to talk to what I would consider a real artist of cinema, you know, doing it the way he wants to do it. And like, it's just rare that I meet a guy that I connect with as quickly as I connected with Joe and like as much and respect his art. So please, enjoy this conversation with me and Joe Swanberg. And also, before we talk to Joe, DJ Copley has been doing some bumper music for us, and here's what he did with some of my guitar noodling that he pulled off of the end of one of the WTFs recently. And sort of remixed it and put some stuff behind it. He's on Twitter as WebPuppy45 if you want to check out his stuff. But now we're going to talk to Joe Swanberg. So enjoy.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
So you have a well-stocked beer fridge.
Definitely. Like, that's if you went into my basement, like, yeah. The fridge has...
Did you shoot Happy Christmas in your house?
Yeah.
That's your
my
house?
That's my house, yeah. Totally. So, that's the basement. Yeah.
The tiki basement?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was like that when you got it?
It was built by the previous owners. Yeah. We just moved in.
Who had lived there for how long?
For a long ass time. Like, we bought it from a 91-year-old woman, and her grandparents built it. So it's been in that family until
Because,
us.
Like, the tiki thing, that's the original tiki craze. So it's like the 50s,
first
40s?
Wave. Yeah, he 40s. Was a GI. I mean, it's that first wave when they actually, like, for the first time went to the, you know, Polynesian islands and stuff. They were fighting the
right.
war out there.
Right.
And then they brought all that stuff home and Americanized it in, like, the kitschiest, weirdest
And it became popular,
way.
Right?
Definitely. And has gone through waves of popularity.
Yeah, kind of came back kind of campy in the 80s.
Yeah.
It was always sort of like part of the, you know, the Betty Page haircut.
Yes, totally.
Area totally. Of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah there's always yeah. a tiki thing.
Tikis and pinups, yeah.
Right. There was also some, like, you know, kind of Mondo film stuff around that stuff too, right? Kind of weird shit.
Yeah.
So, all right, so you buy this old house. You grew up in Chicago, though, or you didn't?
I didn't. I moved around. My dad was an engineer, so I kind of moved like an army kid, even though we weren't military.
An engineer? See, I've talked to some people who have engineer fathers. Like, what does that mean? I mean, what did he do specifically?
Well, he worked for a company called Johnson Controls, which is like a big engineering firm. Yeah. I never quite knew. I mean, I think he did a lot of different things. I just, like, knew he worked for Johnson Controls, and I knew that we moved, like, every 2 years.
It's very funny how many people I talk to, they're like,
yeah, they don't know
I'm
what
not
their
sure
dad
what
did. I know, totally. Also, why haven't I ever asked him? It would
well,
be such
right
an easy thing.
Is he alive?
I'd call him this afternoon and
yeah,
be like,
you're like let's
will
get...
you just walk me through, like, what were you doing when we lived in Georgia? What was happening in California?
What did you walk into the... Wait, you left the house.
Yeah, where'd you go?
You... don't even know. So weird, right?
I know. Maybe he's CIA or something.
But just, like, I doubt
vaguely...
it. But it's just, it also speaks to how pathologically selfish we all are. You know, it's
for
like,
sure.
That's the guy that shows up and apparently I have to listen to him and
he
brings money.
Totally. Like, he's the law. He's the man. He's literally the man.
Was he a good guy?
For sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You seem pretty well adjusted.
Yeah. I like, when I think about it now and the more people I meet, I had the normalest... like most healthy childhood I could imagine. My parents are still married to each other. They're totally in love with each other.
Really?
I have two younger brothers. We always were fine. You know, I mean, it was just like really, I'm like super well adjusted to whatever being an American is.
Yeah.
I'm sure in other places I would be weird, but like for living here right now, I'm like straight down the middle, baby. I'm totally a normal guy.
But I don't know what that means. Like if you went to some other place as a well-adjusted American, how people would be like, what is this freak?
Well, you know, like I probably have like capitalist tendencies that wouldn't like be cool other places. Like American.
I think that's tempered by your career choice.
Yeah, maybe. But you know, like I'm into buying stuff. That would be cool somewhere else.
Sure.
Like I want to own a house. Other cultures are not into like private ownership in that kind of way. Like,
well, I think, so. Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, but you, it seems like you got a reasonable house.
Definitely. It's like, it's a very,
so,
like,
okay. So what else did you learn about the history of that house?
So they did the tiki stuff in the 60s. And then according to the neighbor, I live next door to like a 70-year-old dude who knew them really well. So he's mostly who the history is.
It's an old
working
class neighborhood.
Totally. And it's still it. I mean, like the neighbors on both sides are really awesome. They know everything about their house plus my house. Like my wife and I have learned how to be homeowners from our neighbors.
Right.
Like when I have a problem, I can either call my dad who can try and talk me through it on the phone, or I can go knock on Ray's door next door and be like, Ray, I don't know what's going on here. Like there's water all over my back porch. And he's like, oh, you probably have a leak under the thing.
Yeah.
Let's like, I'll go get my stuff. Let's dig it up. And then I watch him do it. And then the next time I don't need to go knock on his door. I'm like, okay, cool. Ray showed me how to do that.
That happens here too. Like
awesome,
I had this,
right?
like there was a puddle forming in that garden over there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it smells bad.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and I said to my neighbor who's out there, I'm like, what do you think that is? He's like, I think it's shit water.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Because there's that moment where you realize, like, no one's going to fix this.
Doesn't it suck, that moment?
A little bit.
Like,
where you're like,
man,
I got
this is my problem.
Right, somebody better fix this. And you're like, no, I don't think anyone's
I know, it's such a bummer.
You're kind of in charge of that.
Yeah, it's bad.
So you didn't grow up in, where'd you grow up mostly? I mean, every 2 years you moved?
I would say I grew up mostly in Georgia. That was sort of the place during the big formative years for me.
Atlanta?
No, Augusta and then Kingsland. Two different times. Augusta, and then I moved to Anniston, Alabama, and then to Kingsland, Georgia.
But the South and the Midwest is your sort of backdrop.
Yeah, and then weirdly, there was a two-year period where I lived on an island called Kwajalein, which is in the Pacific Ocean. It's part of the Marshall Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the middle of sixth grade to the middle of eighth grade. And then I moved to Illinois, and I've been in Illinois since then.
Kwajalein?
Kwajalein, yeah.
Well, you don't know what your dad was doing on Kwajalein?
I do. I actually, you know, it was only when I was older. I'm not sure what my dad was doing every single day.
Yeah.
But Johnson Controls, you know, they bid on these military contracts. So
right.
Johnson Controls won the contract for a two-year period where they did all the facilities maintenance and, you know, I'm sure, like, oversaw the upkeep of the buildings, installing air conditioning systems, like, whatever stuff needed to happen out there.
Sure.
And then Raytheon underbid them, and then all the Johnson Controls people moved, and all the Raytheon people moved in.
So there's a contractor.
Yeah.
It's but not military contracts, but not weaponry.
Not weaponry.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe Johnson Controls does that, but my dad wasn't doing that. And
you
this
know that
island, part. Here's what's up with this island, which I didn't learn until I was an adult. And then I was like, I wonder what I was doing out on Kwajalein for 2 years. they were testing the Peacekeeper missiles. So they were firing them from, I believe, Los Angeles, like blanks, into the atoll. Kwajalein is an atoll.
Yeah.
So it's sort of shaped like a boomerang.
Yeah.
They were shooting them in there and gauging like accuracy and like tracking like how.
So you could have been sitting on the beach watching missiles come
in.
We
did. We would go. Like on the days where the missiles were going to come in, there was only 3,000 people on the island. Everyone on the island would go out to the beach and you'd see like streaks of light. And it was like, cool.
A splash?
That was cool. Yeah.
Was there a splash?
No, it was too far out.
Oh, it was too far out.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess they wouldn't want too close.
Yeah.
Let's see how accurate.
But you
it really
see, like, five of them all lined up perfectly next to each other, like all coming in.
That's
crazy,
interesting.
Right?
I don't know. I wonder what your brain did with that.
I don't know how it didn't register for me until I was in my 20s.
But you remember doing
and
that.
And then I got on Wikipedia and was just like, "What was going on out there?" And then that's the nasty business, man.
Right, but you still went out there and saw the show.
Definitely. I mean, as a kid, I was like amazing to go see missiles. I didn't think about like, oh, they're figuring out how to kill people better. Yeah. They're just like, they're honing in.
To you, it was just like, oh,
yeah,
cool.
It was like cool missiles.
Well, but you didn't find it was tricky for you moving all the time, making new friends?
It was very tricky, but it also was like director boot camp. I could not have had an upbringing that would have better prepared me to be
for
in
filmmaking?
The film business.
How do you figure that?
Because my whole childhood was you move into a new situation. You have to quickly make friends with everybody
mm-hmm.
who've known each other longer than you've known them.
Right.
You form tight relationships. You figure out your thing in that circumstance.
What does that mean?
It means like, am I the sports guy here? Am I the funniest one? Am I known for eating weird stuff? Like, what's my thing that's going to mean that I can have friends and, like, be
so
cool
So you're
here?
Willing to go any direction.
Well, however it works out. Often it just happens to you.
Yeah.
You
are well-referenced in sports and eating weird things, and you're witty
or
enough.
Whatever the thing needed to be. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, this still happens as an adult. You walk into a group, and you sort of, like, read the room, and you're like, okay, cool, what's, like, How am I going to have a fun time tonight with this group of
am
people?
Am I going to eat
this?
This
guy's clearly already the one they all think is really funny. So I'm not going to like get in a pissing match funny contest.
Maybe you will, though, a little bit.
Maybe.
You'll feel it out?
It depends. If he's not funny at all, then you're like, oh.
What if he's a dick?
I tend to like not engage with dicks.
Oh, okay.
I'm not confrontational in that way. I don't want to like
not even a side swipe. Like you're not even.
I don't think somebody has to be really bad. I was at a bachelor party recently, and there was a guy that was just out of control. And in those situations, I can't stay quiet. Then, and then it got like openly hostile, where I was like, "Dude, you are freaking me the fuck out.
What
like
was
you
it
were
we
bothering
do?
Me." He was really very, very drunk and aggressive.
Oh.
Like he was ruining everyone's good time. And
oh,
I was
right.
like, I'm not going to like my buddy's getting married.
Right.
I'm not going to let this night go downhill like this. Like you need to
chill
out.
Oh, you stepped
out.
In.
Yeah,
right.
I had to.
Take a walk, pal.
Yeah, he was so far across the line. Like it has to get bad. Most of the time I'm just going to be like quietly angry.
You've
that
dealt with drunks before?
A little bit.
Yeah.
We host a lot at my house. So I'm like getting versed in drunkenness. Like I'm starting to like be like a bouncer or something. Like, you know, it's like now I'm around parties often enough that I'm like, okay, cool. All the warning signs are up. This person's is really fucked up. Right.
All right. So you become a director early on because you had to manage situations and get everybody.
I just had to. I mean, I think I became a director because I'm like self-centered and think I have good ideas. I mean, I think that's the director thing. But I had to get good. Moving around a lot growing up, I had to get good at walking into a situation like. Making myself comfortable in that situation,
yeah.
Forming friendships,
yeah.
But then also like, then I had to move and I had to like not. I had to form new friendships.
But
I
so
had
you
to
knew,
not carry every single friendship.
Couldn't
I
be that
ever
emotionally invested.
Me. Yes,
that emotionally invested
in a way. Well, no. Here's what I would say. Ideally, what I would say is that I am that emotionally invested. I'm not fake emotionally invested, but also I know it's going to end.
Mm.
So it's a real investment, but it's also like it can't crush me every time I
it's
move.
It's like heart hardening a bit.
Yeah, in a way, for
right?
sure.
And I think that being involved with a direction or with a film, but not so much. I mean, like a long shoot, that you do
you
build
love
a community.
Yeah,
you develop a community.
Yeah, for me, every movie I've ever done, you forget the rest of the world exists. You're like, these are my friends. This is what's funny to us. This is the restaurant we go to every night. Like, this is my life.
Yeah.
And then the movie ends, and if you're not okay with going and doing that again with a different group of people, you're fucked. I mean, yeah. You'll just be sad the rest of you. You'll be like,
your
it's
life.
Never going to be that good again.
That one movie.
That was the gang, and like now I have to just like recreate that scenario. So in a way, it was just like, you know, the baby steps towards like, here's how you totally invest, and then here's how you also accept the end of that.
Yeah.
And you
how
have
do you do
to.
That?
Because
you seem all, you know, blown out by the fact that you're going to die.
That's like the biggest human accomplishment we've ever done is we forget we're going to die. How amazing is that? We're
the only ones that have that choice. And then so we're just able to want, we have to wander around and look for things that mean things. It's the worst.
Yeah.
This self-awareness
and
knowing that there's a finish line. It's sort of like, well, then this has to, I have to do something.
Yeah.
Something has to mean something.
Yeah.
I'm in a weird position with that right now about like meaning.
Yeah. What are you thinking? Tell me more.
Well, I'm at, you know, I just turned 51 and I've spent a lot of my life sort of like not acknowledging, you know, knowing you have problems or whatever
uh-huh.
they are, or knowing you're hobbled
uh-huh.
in a certain
uh-huh.
way emotionally.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden realizing like, well, all right, like I just got this book where I'm reading this book and it's like, it's really giving me a map of what's really going on and what happened. It's a clinical psychology book.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, oh, so this makes total sense. So now how do I get at that part of myself that needs to come out and needs to figure out how to live in the world and find, you know, like literally questions like, I don't know what I enjoy. What do I want to do today?
Yeah.
I'll choose panic almost every time.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to sit here and dread doing things.
Yeah.
And that's a problem because life is short.
But it's so cool that you're trying to be a better person, that you're like putting the effort in. I mean, it's like really easy not to, right?
I know. But, well, it becomes draining because like once you're on to yourself, it's not so easy not to. When it's just second nature, you know, after a lifetime of people going like, you got to fucking get your shit together
uh-huh.
or you're an asshole or whatever. Eventually it's going to be like, oh, maybe.
But, right.
But it's anyone's journey. You know what I mean? And then you get into that zone where it's sort of like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to fix this. So what can I accept?
And who can I find that can also deal with that shit?
Yeah,
to like be friends and like romantic partners with.
Right.
Like when I think about my wife, it's amazing to me that she loves me and can like spend so much time with me.
Yeah. What about you do you think is difficult?
A lot of things, man. I definitely almost always think I have the best idea of how to like handle a situation.
So you're
it doesn't occur to me
kind
that,
of a know
I,
it
that
all?
Would be wrong.
Right.
I think I'm, you know, like I was the kind of kid that like a lot of stuff came pretty quickly to.
Yeah.
But then also I often then don't put in the work to get a lot better at that thing.
Oh, yeah. See,
it
I
just,
have
like,
that
was
too.
Was pretty quick. I figured it out and I was like pretty good at it very quickly. So then I was like the best at it for a while. And then the people who really put in the work to get good at it got way better than me.
Or else they stay good. Like the weird thing is like there's some part of the brain, like if it's Whether it's an art thing or maybe it's a, you know, bowling or whatever, like there's that need to fucking do really well, either to prove to yourself or to prove to others, just innately, like, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And then you kill it that one time.
Yeah.
And then it never comes back. And, yeah. and you don't want to put the work in. You're sort of yeah. like, yeah, maybe, yeah. maybe I'll focus that hard
yeah.
again.
Yeah. So, you
like
know,
what kind of things were you really good at?
Well, definitely at school. I mean, I was like, could get good grades and, you know, I my younger brother, James, had to put the work in. Didn't come easy to him. Like, mm-hmm. if he wanted to get A's at a subject, he really had to work. I could just like get A's at things. I could like figure out how that thing worked enough to like be okay at it.
Right. You were able to contextualize.
Yeah. I was like, here's how school works. Here's the dynamics. Like, this is how a test goes. There's a system to most things, you know.
See, I'm
that's
bad
like
at that, man.
Different.
I can't compartmentalize very well unless I have to, like, you know, for secrecy reasons.
yeah,
but
when
I can't.
You know, sensitive information.
Sure, but it's interesting because like you are the way you are. Like I saw you briefly. I went to a screening of Happy Christmas at the Roxy, the last night of that guy.
Yeah, totally.
Who worked there.
Mike Keegan, yeah.
Mike Keegan, I didn't know him, but I walked in just to see the movie out of nowhere. And we were seeing the showing after you spoke.
Uh-huh.
But we got there early and you were on the Skype.
Oh, cool.
So that was the first time I encountered you.
Yeah,
cool. You were talking live to other people. And I'm like, this guy seems to be a smart guy. I should probably talk to him. Talk to that guy.
It's nice that I come across that way. I'm happy to hear that.
No, you come across so well adjusted and like you've got your head on straight and you know you come from this nice family, but your movies are difficult.
I think you have to have a very safe, protective, healthy home life to make difficult artwork.
But the thing is that the fact that you're so consciously doing artwork is an amazing thing. Like, I don't think anybody's doing independent movies like you do them and continuing to do them without really too much of a hint of it, of it's some sort of launching pad.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen all of them because you've made like 20 fucking feature films in what, 9 years?
Yeah, I've made a lot.
But the point is that what you do is not easy to do. It's not easy to balance. It's not easy to make compelling. There's a lyricism and a poetry to it that is specifically art movies. This is not just indie movies.
Yeah.
You make art movies.
Yeah.
And,
well, yeah, for sure. I mean, I grew up, I fell in love with that and then have like always aspired.
Well, what's
to
your
that.
Theory?
My theory in the artists that I've known is that there are the people who are making art to be loved by others, who like sort of are lacking, this is very broad. So of course, like everybody doesn't fall easily into one or the other category,
okay.
But like there's a way if you sort of are feeling a lack of love in your personal life or sort of a lack of a foundation of love,
mm-hmm.
I think it's easy to become an artist because it's a very quick way to get like love from a bunch of strangers, right?
Mm-hmm. If they get it.
Yeah, or whatever. Or you can bend yourself to make them get it. Like, I think that you know, if that's the path you're on, you can figure out an area where you can find that love from
as a creative
the external.
Person.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you don't need the work to provide love, then you can make challenging work because you're like, I'm okay as a person. Like I'm married. I have a child. My parents love me. Like I'm doing all right. I have like a bedrock of stability and love. So now the artwork can push people. It can challenge people because if they don't like it, I'm okay still. But if you need them to like it because that's where your love's going to come from, I think then you make like, could make safe, likable.
Or right. If you
music,
need to love,
movies,
but it depends
books,
how complicated
whatever.
It are. So like the thing is, like, so if your model is true and you feel stable, but you still have to put some element of passion, your explorations are emotional. So you
yes.
may not be seeking the love from those, but the challenge you're presenting, I just have a hard time completely believing that it comes all from emotional stability. It seems to me that you are working out equations and possibilities emotionally on screen that must be percolating inside you. You can't be that detached.
Definitely, I am. But
you're not.
Here's what I would say. Like, if my relationship's in a good place and my wife and I are in a good place, I can make a movie about what it would be like to cheat, right?
Yeah.
And then I don't have to worry that movie's going to fuck up my relationship. That can be a conversation my wife and I can be having while I'm making the movie.
Right.
I can explore treacherous, emotional territory in a very real way, like in a way that hits close to home. Like, for instance, with Happy Christmas, that's a movie that came out of conversations my wife and I were having after we had a kid, where she felt really like stuck, like trapped at home with that kid. And like
she had bigger dreams.
Well, definitely. We met in film school. She's a filmmaker also. And like, I got to, like, after the birth of my son, because I could make more money than she could at the time, like, it just made sense for our family that, you know, like, I kept working.
Right.
And she stayed home.
Practical.
And then, you know, we sort of like reached the tipping point of that where like, this isn't cool with me anymore. Like, it can't just keep going this way. And
because I'll die inside and hate you.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what that movie's about. It's shot in my house. My son and I are in it. Like, that's a movie.
Your son was good.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing, man.
He got some good stuff.
Yeah, he's a total sweetheart. But, you know, like that movie pushes a lot of buttons, not only for my wife and I, but for a lot of other people who maybe find themselves in that same position, right?
Well, I think that the other thing that movie did, you know, I guess we can work back because that's the most recent movie, is that the character that Anna Kendrick played, you know, for even someone my age, how old are you?
I'm 33.
That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It feels...
You've made 18 movies.
It feels old and young at the same time to me right now. Like, I keep this picture... There's this picture of Robert Altman making Nashville.
Yeah.
That I like to keep handy because he's... maybe he's 50 or maybe he's, like, into his 50s. He looks so playful, and like if you look at his career, he's like still figuring his shit out, like still like inventing stuff, still like totally changing the game and the way movies are made.
At Nashville, yeah.
Yeah, it's really useful for me to have that around because though I made a lot of stuff, like I mean the stuff that I've made so far is so, I hope that the movies get so much better, and like I want to definitely make sure that like 20 years from now, I still feel like an amateur, you know, like I still have a spirit where I'm like, cool, let's reinvent it every time out.
He took some weird risks.
He's amazing, man. He really...
Like quintets? Not...
Yeah, he has made very, very bizarre movies.
Yeah, man.
And bad ones, too, which I really like about him.
Which ones do you think are bad?
O.C. and Stigs, I think, is really bad.
That was late. That seemed like a cash grab.
That's like an attempt at making a teen comedy.
It's a money thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And he shot The Player too, didn't he?
Yeah.
That was tight.
Yeah.
I mean, like really that, good. It's interesting when someone breaks from his own style and says, I can make a regular movie.
Yeah.
Here's a regular movie.
Yeah, it's like a 90s Hollywood movie.
Yeah. But it was so dark. It was so like, such a nice kick in the balls to the industry.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So, well, that frames something interesting about you is that because you have the facility that he did not have, which is the ability to shoot on cameras in a relatively expensive way and the compulsion to continue learning and pushing your own creative envelope, that the fact that you're 33, it's like, do you feel like at some point you're gonna be like, well, I'm gonna get this art shit out of my system and maybe level up on a vision that's a little more palatable to the general population?
I think that's happening anyway. I mean, I it's maybe like a just a getting older thing, or maybe it's a being a dad and a husband now, but the last couple movies I've made in essentially the same way that I've always been working, and yet they feel more accessible to people.
Just Happy
because
Christmas
the themes
and...
are getting, and Drinking Buddies, the one before that.
Drinking Buddies feels different to me.
How does it feel to you?
There were moments in it that felt, you know, kind of a little more, I don't know if they're mainstreamy because like I, you know, Ron Livingston, you know, brings a certain amount of recognition
for sure.
And you know, the backdrop of the brewery was okay. And some of the relationships were okay. But it, like for me, what really seemed to be most like you was the tension of the friend / love dynamic and that other guy's, you know, the marriage of the other people.
Yeah.
But she, the primary character, was this is a difficult character. You know, I don't know necessarily at the end of it all that she was ever going to really be able to access her emotions.
Yeah, she's in a bad spot, I think. It's a complicated character.
It just seemed a little, I guess so. I think it was because coming into your work, and I know Duplass and I've watched their stuff, but the whole movement that you're involved in, you know, happened after I was in a, you know, I wasn't on the inside of things.
Yeah.
You know, I missed Mumblecore.
Yeah, and, sure.
It's not my generation, so I got to go back. So starting with Happy Christmas and then immediately knowing and hearing you talk about it for 10 minutes before right. I got to watch
right.
the movie.
Right, right. That's a crazy context to see a movie.
Well, it was
the
because...
Q&A beforehand.
Because, look at... I've never seen that before, ever. The squirrel just climbed down the screen. We just saw a squirrel stomach.
It must happen a lot. I bet it happens 5 times a day, and you've just never been
never
here to witness
it. Never seen it.
It's a pretty ingenious way to get around.
It just crawled down the screen.
I know. Squirrels are amazing, man. They're very versatile.
Yeah, I barely really pay that much attention to them. And they're around. I wouldn't even identify them if someone said, do you have wildlife? It'd be like coyotes, skunks, possums, raccoons. Squirrels wouldn't even make
yeah.
the list.
It's a big. That was a big squirrel.
Big. But the fact that you shot on 16, like there was something about, for me, as an older guy, and like you came up in film school where you didn't fucking have to shoot on 16 if you didn't want to, did
right.
you?
No. Well, I went to a really old school film school. So while I didn't have to, most people did. And you got the sense from the professors that they very much preferred it and would want
to do
but that.
But there are certain skills. I mean, outside of understanding, you know, how to really control aperture and how to really get the most out of your actors and how to think economically.
Yeah.
But like, you know, editing 16 is useless.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, unless you're doing something.
It absolutely is. But it's also how I learned. So I have.
That's how you learned how to put things together.
On a flatbed editor, cutting 16 millimeter. Yeah.
Because I thought just the tone of it, you know, the amount, like, it's not that you have to forgive anything, but you realize, like, even when I watched the, even Drinking Buddies, which is not shot on film.
No, it's shot on video.
Of course. Right?
Yeah.
So, and even the one with that I just watched with Jane Adams.
All the Light in the Sky.
It's a great movie.
Oh, thanks, man.
You like that movie?
I'm very proud of it. Yeah.
But what you can do with a camera just with the ocean, what you had to do, you could not have done with 16.
Right.
Ever. So there's your context. You know, everything's saturated a certain way.
Yeah.
But it does have that feeling of like, you know, like when I was younger, it's like, I'm watching a movie.
Yeah.
You know, you can't manufacture that.
It has that for me too. It's a really, it's the second it hits the screen, chemically your body feels different.
Right.
You're like, I'm looking at something shot on film.
This is a film.
Yeah, I know.
So making that choice, where did that come from?
It came from a fear that it was going to go away. I mean, I having gone to film school and done work on film and then sort of spent 10 years making movies on video, I always told myself, well, I'll get back to film. You know, like that's, once it's an option again, it'll sort of be on the table. And it just kept becoming less and less of an option. I mean, even if you have a little bit of money, nobody wants you to shoot on film anymore. You know, studio movies are not shooting on film anymore, even though that line item would be a tiny one in the
right.
general budget. They're still like, why would we even spend an extra $70,000 that we don't have to spend? And so I got very afraid that I might go the rest of my career and never make a film, a real film. And so I just decided to do it.
So up to Happy Christmas, you hadn't done a feature on 16?
No.
That was your first feature on film?
Yeah.
How was it for you?
Great. Really a nice experience.
The economy of it must really raise the stakes for everybody.
I noticed it in a very positive way.
Because you're working with actresses that have probably never shot on film.
Most of them hadn't, I don't think.
Melanie Lynskey, who's a genius.
Yeah.
Anna Kendrick. And just this, there's this idea that, like, in the world that they grew up in, it's sort of like, we can do as many takes as the day will allow.
Yeah.
Because it costs nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe, like, very early in their careers, they had done indies
student
on film.
Student film, right.
I bet it had been, like, a decade, at least for all of us.
And you felt that. Did you have to have a conversation about that?
It was a part of how I talked about the movie. I mean, I let them know that that was going to be a priority, that it was important to me to do this one on film, and that, that was going to be where a lot of the money was going to go, and that we were just going to make that choice.
But you know, if you work completely improvisationally.
Yeah.
So it's a yeah. gamble.
Well, we budgeted a 4-to-1 shooting ratio, which meant we 4 takes was the most we could do.
And you stuck by that?
We came in under, actually.
Huh.
Yeah.
Because you just let it roll.
Yeah. We did that, and also I'm my own editor. So when I like something and I know I'm going to use it, I don't need coverage then after that. You know, we don't need to beat around the bush and say, like, well, just as a safety net, let's go ahead and shoot this and this and this. Because it's my movie.
Right.
That take was great. I'm going to use that take. I'm not going to give myself a note later that I want to cut to an insert shot. So let's not shoot the insert shot.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, that's a confidence of a creative person.
That comes from having made 17 movies already, too. You know, I mean,
you get a feel for it, and you're also acting in it.
Yeah.
You know, I know, like, CK is a friend of mine, and he has that same sort of, you have to have that kind of weird creative fortitude to direct your own movies and then to cut them and then to be in them. You can't have that thing you're talking about,
right?
The need for love. Like, how'd everyone else feel?
I know.
Someone's got to drive.
Right.
So, but it's interesting to me with Happy Christmas that it wasn't, you knew the story, right? So in your mind, when you set out, that was a pretty specific story. This girl comes in, she's your sister, she's got her own problems. And that character was pretty amazing. What I was about to say before was that no matter what age you are, I'm only 51, so I grew up post 60s or whatever. There's always that strange, entitled, kind of like troubled substance wise, but you know, not sure what she wants to do with her. Like I recognized her.
Yeah.
Like it's been around for a while. I don't think it would have been around in the 40s in the same way, but there's that character. And she's really the pivotal thing, the changer. And you hate her in a bit.
Yeah.
Not hate her, but sort of like, oh, fuck.
For sure. I hope.
But why, how did you construct that story? I mean, I understand that you had your
wife. Coming out of really personal stuff. Also, my younger brother, James, who was not nearly as bad in real life as Anna's character is in the movie, but my younger brother, James, had come and lived with us after we bought the house. Uh-huh. And you know, you reach a certain age where you just, it's hard to have people in your space for a long period of time.
Even if they're your family.
Yeah, even if they're your family and even if they're great and even if they're helping out, you sort of, you get used to a level of privacy and a level of autonomy. And then suddenly, you know, he was living in the basement. That basement is where my wife and I hang out. It's where the only TV in the house is down in that basement. It's sort of where we go if we just want to like catch up on a movie or show. And he was down there. So even just by being there, he was in the way, even if he was the politest, best house guest ever, you know?
And you feel like you have to do it because he's family.
I wanted to do it. And also, like, you know, he had gone to school in Lexington, Kentucky. He was ready to move, you know, out of the college town and move to the city. I thought that that was a good idea. So I was happy to be able to be helpful. It's nice to be an older brother and be in a position to help if somebody asks.
Right.
And so, you know, all of it was great. I mean, it was really nice to have him with us and... you know, he has a weird relationship to the movie because it really makes it look like he was a fucking mess who like, you know, really fucked our house up. But he wasn't.
You had to explain that to him?
We've talked about it a couple times, but, you know, he wasn't the best house guest ever either.
But yeah, but he's your brother.
He's my younger brother, too. Yeah, and I try and be generous to younger
people. But it's interesting, though, because I've had to deal with that with my father and stuff because of the TV show, like where you're like, well, you threw me under the bus. I'm like, no one knows that but me and you. You know what I mean? But you can't explain that to somebody. It's like, no one's going to make an assumption.
It's a very tricky thing if you're going to use your real life in your art.
Before I get away from this, the one thing I've noticed in watching the films is how deeply the narrative expectations of films are plowed into us almost like as old as from when we're children.
For sure.
So it's very interesting to watch your movies. Like, even when I was watching Happy Christmas, you're sort of waiting, like, something's going to get bad. This shit, something's going to go down, man. Like, is she going to get in a car accident? Yeah. Like, the big turn was when she burnt a pizza.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, like, that was a moment.
Yeah.
And even in the stars, what is it, the sky?
What's All the Light in the Sky.
All the Light in the Sky. Yeah. Do you know what the biggest moment in that the most, jarring moment was for you?
I mean, that big conversation she has with Larry Fessenden in the movie where he does the Jack Nicholson impersonation.
That was great.
To me, feels like the crux. That's like my big climactic moment is two people on a couch talking for 20 minutes.
I thought that the most powerful moment in that fucking movie was when that coat rack came off the wall. Yeah.
That's my action scene.
That was it.
Yeah.
But it was satisfying. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. Like, after she leaves that.
Yeah.
And then
that
thing just goes clunk. And I'm like, that's the end of the second act.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. That's really funny. Yeah. That's my sense of humor. I mean, that coat rack coming off the wall to me is the funniest thing I could do in that. That's so totally my sense of humor. Like,
but it's also very telling. And it's like, and because you're working improvisationally and you're hanging this stuff on a loose story that's based on emotion.
Yeah.
That to find those things that hang your narrative on literally.
Yeah.
That's sort of the trick of making movies the way you do.
Yeah.
And it's got you, either people are going to feel it or they're not.
Yeah. I mean, I would say even that there is just like, you're already in a very small pool of people that are even capable of feeling it. And then some of them are going to feel it and some of them are not.
It's interesting because, like, for me, it's like it brings me back to a different time where, you know, where I was studying film in college and, you know, you had to be hyper attentive and patient and try to, like, you know, someone has told you that this is the good stuff. And then you just got to sit there, you know, watching St. Joan, you know, going like, yeah. What am I doing? Like Red Desert. Mm-hmm. Antonio, and you're mm-hmm. like, I can't, what am I missing?
Yeah.
And it's like, you can't be so hard on yourself.
Yeah. It's, I'm like the kind of person that automatically bristles when somebody tells me something's genius, you know, like
no, yeah, yeah,
this
yeah.
is a masterpiece. That's a terrible. And then I like fold my arms and I'm like, all right, prove it.
But now you're in film school, right?
Yeah.
But so like you got, there's something, I mean, like some of your stuff is kind of Godardian.
Definitely.
I mean, like that. Some stuff like
his playfulness with editing is like for sure always been a big influence.
Yeah, but even like I kind of got the feeling watching Silver Bullet when she's playing with the gun in the mirror that was almost an homage in a way.
Yeah, that stuff. It's funny how that stuff filters through. Like I sort of landed upon the way that I work specifically to avoid references. I feel like I went. You know, like I was in high school when Pulp Fiction came out, and I feel like that changed everything.
Yeah.
There was then a period of like 3 or 4 years where every movie that came out was just a knockoff of Pulp Fiction, it felt like.
Right.
Everyone was just trying to do that thing.
A knockoff of knocking off movies.
Yeah, exactly. A knockoff like, of pastiche. A knockoff.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was like a really, that was the time period where I was falling in love with movies. And so I had to go outside of that stuff because it just got so similar.
Well, where'd you go?
I mean, I worked in a video store, and we had the ability to order movies for the store. So, you know, I was just like trying to watch a lot of documentaries, a lot of foreign films,
Cassavetes,
a lot of like exploitation trash. I mean, I definitely was into trauma movies. You know, I was just like sort of trying to dip my toes in all the waters to see what was registering and also what was achievable.
Trauma movies.
Definitely.
Yeah. But you did, like, did you make horror movies early on?
No, but I probably thought I would. I mean, I was drawn to them. I was drawn to the ability to do them on a low budget. They felt achievable to me.
Well, you kind of pulled that out. You kind of dealt with it in Silver Bullet.
Definitely.
As early as you needed to.
That's like, as horror movie as like my interests would allow me to get, probably.
Well, it gets like, but what about Cassavetes? No? Yeah.
Cassavetes only via osmosis. Like, I've never really seen Cassavetes movies, but I'm was influenced by the people who were influenced by Cassavetes. So I'm...
Who would they be?
Anybody who was like an 80s or 90s American independent filmmaker. Everyone.
Right.
I mean, he's the godfather, right? Like, he sort of changed the game. And then, in one way or another, everybody who has the gall to pick up a camera and go with their friends and say, we're going to make a movie, is influenced by Cassavetes.
Right.
So, while he's not, for me, a direct influence, and in a way now it's like those movies have become holy because I know that I'll like them when I finally see them. So I've sort of been waiting for the perfect circumstance. Like, I'm kind of waiting for a Cassavetes retrospective where I can just go and watch them all in a week.
Just get the Criterion box.
Well, I
want to
see them in a movie theater for the first time.
Okay.
I'm all waiting for that.
Maybe you should build a theater. Maybe you should. Why don't you?
I could talk to maybe like somebody and just see if.
Well, you're in Chicago. Go curate a.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually.
Why don't you curate something like movies I haven't seen but I want to see?
Yeah, that's a good idea, man. Yeah. Yeah, shit I've been meaning to watch. that's a good idea, man.
You should do it.
I might do that.
And you get to watch it for the first time
get
in the theater.
Get prints of it. And, yeah.
That'd be fucking awesome.
I like it.
I think I've always. The Celebration, that film.
Thomas Vinterberg's movie? Yeah, it's amazing.
What is that?
Yeah, I saw that in film school. That was a big one because I mean, what's great about movies like The Celebration is you no longer have permission not to go make a movie because you look at it and you're like, it didn't cost much money. It's all it is really compelling performances and a really compelling story. Like, now you have no excuses. You have to, if you think you have the stuff, now go prove it.
That movie did that for you.
For sure. All those Dogma films were really important to me.
Yeah.
Because, like, what I love about Lars von Trier and those early Dogma guys was they at a very important time in my life, they took all of the emphasis off of production design and slickness, which is the one thing you can't do right in film school. You can't do that.
Right.
You have to have a lot of money and be working with really good people. And also, that changes all the time. Like, our idea of what's slick and expensive looking shifts every couple years. So even if you got good at one thing, you'd be out of touch by the time you, like, could put the resources together to fake it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, like, so by taking the emphasis 100% off of that, and by calling that stuff bullshit and saying the only thing that matters is actors and a handheld camera and a story, I was like, ooh, yes.
Now,
like,
I can work.
Now there's a context for the work, even.
Yeah, precedent has been set.
Yeah. Like, a guy who did the other thing really well just said that the other thing is bullshit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I was so liberated to just, like, get out of film school, grab my friends, grab a video camera, and just make a movie.
But it also seems like, you know, you'll make a movie sort of at the drop of a hat.
If I meet a cool actor or there's a cool idea that, like, enters the ether and I feel like I can, like, snatch it and go do it, I'll go do it.
Well, what about the thing where you obviously shot some of the Sky movie and Silver Bullet simultaneously, or you had leftover footage?
Several of them simultaneously. There was a period of time where I was working on, I think, four movies at once that had a lot of the same actors in them, and there was just, like, a ton of overlap.
And there's certain people, it seems, that can do what you want them to do, and certain people that probably couldn't.
When I meet, like, people who can do it, I hold on to them very tightly.
Well, like Anna and Melanie and Jane, for sure.
For sure.
That dude who was in the Sky movie?
Larry
Jack
Fessenden.
Nicholson guy?
Yeah, Larry Fessenden, who's also a director whose work I really like.
Yeah, and I like the other kid, too, the one she slept with. I like him, too.
Ty West.
He's been in some other movies.
Kent Osborne.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, those guys, if you look at my movie, Kent Osborne's in almost everything I've ever made. Like, he's like, I get an idea, and then I'm like, well, Kent would be perfect for that.
But this is also familiar to you. These are types of people that you kind of know in your life. Like, they're familiar to me. They are creative people. Like, there's a in the world of where creative people work when they're not being creative, and also how they carry themselves, whether they've turned their back on their creativity or not, there's a certain community to that.
Definitely.
You know what I mean? If they're not actually, you know, actualizing creativity, they're a brewer.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Definitely.
It's all very familiar to me, but in Silver Bullet, like, there's some real kind of, like, and not that you need to reference it, but, you know, the fact that, you know, she's playing with a gun and he's behind her.
Oh, definitely. That is a reference. I mean, that's like taking the whole history of movies into account there.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, that's a scene from a movie.
Right.
Purposefully. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So it wasn't, you're not lying to yourself.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
Just filtered in. I'm like, yeah, Kubrick.
Dude, I just I don't even ever think of anything. Like, I haven't even watched any movies. I just wanted to be pure, man.
Did you watch that documentary about the Shining?
Yeah.
What?
I had a really good time with that.
Me too.
It's really fun.
But the only thing that was interesting to me was the one guy who said that, you know, that he was such a deep intellectual that he might not have had any clue that he was a vessel.
Mm-hmm.
For these layers of
conspiracy theories
of significance, of symbolic significance, of semiotics.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, once you get hung up on that, what was it, a flower or the box of Calumet?
Yeah.
What, or
the coffee can that's turned a certain way or whatever.
Right. Yeah. It's like you have a really hard time believing, like, Kubrick's we're going to.
I know, yeah.
Because
Hold
of
on,
the
I
Indians.
I got to adjust that. Yeah.
But somebody did.
Sure.
But your movies are not loaded up the same way.
Not at all. I mean, I'm hoping that it's really. It's a lot of it's accidental. I mean, I'm trying to create an environment on set where accidents can happen because my feeling is that you only innovate by accident, that nobody's smart enough to have a new idea that just, like, takes things into a new realm.
Or it doesn't feel somehow, so constructed.
Yeah. Somehow there's, like, a limitation that forces you to solve a problem in a new way. And that, for me, was always kind of the guiding light, was let's put ourselves in a situation where we don't know what's going to happen, where I have to follow the action the way a documentary camera person would have to follow a real life event. Like, I'm not setting marks where you start here and you have to walk over there. I'm just saying do it, and then I'll try and capture it. And by not capturing it, then I'll have to figure out how to edit the scene in a cohesive way. And then I might accidentally do something interesting or several interesting things. That changes based on the movie. Like, obviously, with Drinking Buddies, there was a level of improvisation and and sort of a space where accidents could happen within the context of stronger narrative and better lighting,
right,
let's say, or right, something like that. And once you introduce better lighting, you sometimes have to set marks. You know, things change. Things start to change.
Show business, man.
Show business, baby. You're now you're making a movie. And so in a way, I have more recently embraced movies, the way movies are made, because I did so many things outside of the bounds of how movies are made. And I also got to a point where I wasn't creating situations where accidents were happening anymore. I was like too familiar with all those scenarios.
I'd but you done weren't scripting dialogue.
Film. Yeah. So I still wasn't scripting dialogue, but I was like, I don't know. It just wasn't feeling chaotic the way it maybe did on the early movies. And I was like, you know what? I've become a director.
So you're okay with it?
Yeah. And now I'm like trying to do that for a period of time just to like see if I can get good at that thing too.
Well, it sounds to me what you were doing with once you were freed by Dogma Films,
yeah,
in terms of process, was you were like, all right, so, you know, I'm going to treat this organically. Yeah, because I have the freedom to do that and I have the equipment and it doesn't cost me a lot to treat this as an organic process where surprises can happen. I can learn about myself through structuring these loose narratives to see how people engage emotionally.
Yeah.
And I can put myself in it and take the parts of myself that maybe are not that high quality people stuff.
Yeah.
And resolve, because like in Silver Bullet, I mean, the stuff that you were dealing with in that character that you played was too, it was too real, some of that.
Pettiness, jealousy,
but just the hilarious, but yeah, that stuff, like straight up artist kind of stuff. Maybe it's not the kind of artist you are, but it's
It is, for sure. I'm playing myself in that
movie. I know, but the funniest thing is that in every scene, you're way into that overly large book.
Yeah,
that like
yeah,
that you're yeah, always reading this book and it's like got 500 pages
yeah,
and you're well into it.
Yeah.
And never once did I think that you had read the other 400 pages necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're sitting there going like, you know, having this discussion about form
yeah,
because you're so insecure
yeah,
and you're trying to act like you know more than
yeah,
you do.
Yeah.
But I thought it was hilarious that that book was always like right.
Yeah.
That the answer, because
yeah,
I've been that guy. It's like, it's in here. This is the book.
Yeah.
What book was that?
That was The Complete Plays of Chekhov.
Was it important to you at the time?
Well, we were basing Silver Bullets off of The Seagull. So we had like stolen some character types from that play.
I wouldn't have known that because I'm not that much of an intellectual.
Nor am I. I mean, Jane Addams turned me on to The Seagull when we started the process of doing Silver Bullets. She was like, you should read The Seagull. It might be useful. And it was super useful.
But like the stuff you were doing with color and with video, and then you know, like some of that stuff was shot on 16, the horror stuff, was it?
Or just Super 8.
Super 8 even. So, but like to make decisions about, you know, montages like the ones you did in that, I mean, that was like fucking, you know, like.
Stan Brakhage?
Yeah. It was straight up Brakhage shit.
Well, definitely. The film school I went to, Brakhage was a really important person there.
Because like the, you know, to take in Brakhage at that time, when I went to a Brakhage festival, I'm like, okay, yeah, I gotta you had to, like, I had to sit there and go like, I like Mark Rothko. I understand. I had to make this transition.
Yeah.
To understand that like film can do this.
Yeah.
It may not be everyone's idea of a night out.
Yeah.
But you can do it.
Yeah.
But I felt like some of that stuff in there, to have the confidence to string those kind of images together and that kind of movement and those kind of colors specifically for a poetic effect is ballsy, and not many people are doing it.
It's not very valued right now culturally. I mean, that's why a lot of people aren't doing it.
Well, I don't know if it was ever valued except in the world that it was
maybe
valued
not
in.
Maybe you're right. I might be like a little
esoteric,
nostalgic and like...
Well, you're film school nostalgic.
Yeah.
Maybe. Because, you know, those guys were fighting...
It was valued in film school. Yeah, yeah.
And because those guys were fighting exactly what, you know, you were fighting initially, which is that, you know, to think that everyone's hacking on Tarantino, hacking on other things, and then the idea of production value. I mean, people like Godard and Brakhage to an extreme were saying like, fuck all that.
Yeah.
Let's bring it back to high art.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even
yeah,
like they were turning their back on everybody, on Wells. They didn't fucking,
yeah,
it's all garbage.
Yeah.
I can just put pink up for 2 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough to sift through which of that stuff is legitimate and which of that stuff is laziness. It's hard. I mean, in film school, that was a big challenge for me with somebody like
Brakhage. Because you could be the character in that movie and be full of shit. It's
very easy to just look at that stuff and say, this is lazy bullshit. Anyone could do this.
And then defend it.
Why do we think this guy's so great?
Right, but you as an artist, then, like, you can do that and rationalize it. Like, you know, like, this is your vision. But the difference between you and the reason that I'm talking to you at all is that there's a tremendous difference between, you know, like, an established abstract artist and then a guy who just says, like, anyone can do that.
I agree with you.
Of course. I mean, if that wasn't true, we'd all be in trouble. And we'd be surrounded by, you know, undecipherable garbage.
Yeah, but, you know, frauds slip through the system all the time.
For a little while.
And sometimes are so established that forever they do. But, I mean,
but if they're made, but
here's
that,
what I'll say.
But then you're getting
it's very dangerous to just accept that somebody's great. It's very dangerous because you always should investigate as an artist.
You should
decide that you like Brakhage. You shouldn't just assume you like
Brakhage. Right, but as an artist, see, that's the difference. See, like, a fraud can exist in a world. If that fraud is making money for somebody else, who gives a fuck if he's a fraud?
I see what you're saying.
It's a different context.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to talk specifically in the context of art, then there's different parameters, and then the inside struggle in between artists and justifying that and the critics that need to justify it or establish it.
Yeah.
Out in the fraud world, hey, the guy made $1 million for us last year.
Yeah.
So, okay, he's a fraud, but, you know, he's probably going to make two next year.
But there becomes a system. I mean, I don't know if you have this feeling when you watch movies, but there, at this point in time, there is a kind of a movie that wins Academy Awards, right?
Like, sure.
It's not a...
But that's politics, all fucking politics.
Well, I totally agree. But when I was a kid, that kind of movie also was the kind of movie that felt like the best movie to me, right?
Yeah.
The older I get and the more I make of my own stuff and the more I see of other people's stuff, the less those worlds seem to overlap, right? So there's, like, the marketing machine that decides that, like, you know... David O. Russell, Martin Scorsese, Paul Thomas Anderson, David Fincher, these guys, like, okay, these guys make important awardsy movies. Everything they make is going to be marketed and pushed through that system, aimed at those release dates, aimed at winning those Oscars. And then, like, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But it's all, you know, it's all sort of, like, belongs to that world.
Well, but you know, fortunately, out of that list, you know, which is one list, not tremendously schlocky.
I totally agree. They're all amazing artists.
Because there's a schlock component, too, to some of that.
So those movies come out, and they sort of are pushed through the system as the important arty awards movies, right? But, like, I saw that movie, The Conjuring, that James Wan movie. I think that movie's a masterpiece. That movie's never going to be nominated for an Oscar. They're closed off to it before it even exists.
I didn't see it. Was it good?
I think it's amazing, man. It's really, to me, the best crafted and best, for certain people, the best acted movie of the year. Like, Lily Taylor's performance in The Conjuring is certainly better than anyone who won an Oscar last year, right? But because it's a horror movie directed by James Wan, that avenue was never open to it from inception.
They weren't playing the
game. That bothers me.
Right.
Right? That like, it's so much just a part of how the industry markets stuff that certain movies are eligible for awards and other movies never will be. And they're not looking at the level of quality. They're just looking at, like, is it that kind of movie or
does
not?
Does it honor the system that we put into place?
I think that's why it's dangerous, and that's why it's like you always have to investigate and decide for yourself if you even think a certain filmmaker is any good.
Yeah.
Let alone a master.
Right. But a lot of times, like, sadly, like you said, they may not be frauds. But they might not be great.
Well, if you can make a movie that consistently makes a lot of money, that's very hard to do. I don't consider those people frauds.
Right.
Actually, I think these days, my suspicion is that it's easier to fraudulently sneak into the important, serious art world of things than it is the commercial world of things. Because the commercial world of things... it either works or it doesn't.
Yeah, it makes money or it doesn't.
There's a million shades of gray in the art world of things.
Right, so. Exactly. In independent cinema and that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah, there can be some real some garbage.
Yeah, some garbage that like still has a place and still some, like, yeah, because you're blowing smoke up that person's ass. And...
Right, but you have like I've decided somehow or another that, you know, you're the only guy I know that's like, you know, making these art movies in a way that is poetic and requires a sort of openness to allowing the thing to not give you what you want.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And reckon with it.
I'm asking a lot of the audience. I'm asking them to participate in that with me.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a big ask. And, you know, as I've gotten older, it's an even bigger, I'm realizing what a big ask it is, because I don't get to the movies as often as I used to. You know, it's a bigger deal for me to make the time to go to a movie theater and see a movie. And so, I think when I was younger, I took it for granted, and I made some, lazy choices because I didn't, feel the responsibility that I feel now towards the audience.
Well, okay. So now as you're shifting, as you know, you went to film school and then you decided to actually take advantage through, you know, your compulsion and desire to figure out some things about the medium and about yourself. And you've had all this experience that you've done on your own terms completely. What crossroads are you at? I mean, how do you not end up becoming a college professor?
That's been an easy choice not to make, because I wouldn't be able to make enough stuff if I was a college professor. Because,
but you know what I'm saying, though, you have an integrity that you're, you know, that there's some part of you, like, you know, I know your cohorts, I know Duplass,
yeah,
I know of Lynn Shelton,
yeah,
I know of people that come out of a real sort of like scrapper indie, ideal, but you have a commitment to a vision. It seemed that some of them were sort of like, well, I'm going to find my place in this machine here,
yeah.
Like, you're in Chicago.
Yeah.
You just bought a house in Chicago. Yeah. You're not like, I'm coming to LA tomorrow.
Yeah.
So what's the plan, Joe?
The plan is to have as much ownership as possible in my own work, so that when that work does well, I benefit from it. And the plan is to just always work with really talented, good people. And I think that the plan doesn't have to be a lot more complicated than that, because it's always going to make me wake up in the morning excited to go do it. If I'm around people who are stimulating, who are challenging me, but who are good people, like I just can't deal with a ton of bullshit. And like, I am really bad creatively when I'm around people who are insecure, or who are like mean, or, you know, like all those sort of things. So I'm like sort of sniffing around, and just like, I have my antenna up and I'm just looking for people. Like, I found Anna Kendrick, right? She's somebody who I hope to make 70 movies with. Like, we get it together. And like, the thing that we can do in the most economical, efficient way possible, because there's no wasted time. There's no bullshit. There's no like that I have to like send the offer in the certain way and take her out to dinner and then like send roses on the first day of shooting and whatever. She's like, let's go make a good movie, and that's all we have to worry about right now. I'm not gonna like make a thing of it.
Yeah.
And Jake Johnson is like that. Olivia Wilde's like that. Ron Livingston's like that. Like, those people that I worked with on Drinking Buddies, I promise you will see them a lot.
Yeah.
Throughout the rest of my career. And within the context of that, if the doors to doing like bigger movies, like a studio movie or something, for instance, opens, my guess is it will open in the context of doing a studio movie with Anna, or doing a studio movie with Olivia, or doing a studio movie with Jake. And then we'll go do our thing with different resources, with a bigger crew, with whatever. But in my heart, I'll still be going to work with Anna.
But here's my question.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, then all of a sudden the collaboration becomes much broader and much bigger.
I've never done it. Yeah.
Right.
I assume, but...
Then you're going to have to deal with that the horrible menace of production value.
Sure, sure.
And set deck.
Yeah.
And, you know, construction.
Yeah. Totally. But, I mean, this could be... We should, like... you know, we'll follow up in like two years and see if I've done a studio movie and if I like am back in Chicago, like licking my wounds or something. But I love a lot of big budget movies. truly love them. Yeah. Like The Conjuring, right?
Of course.
This horror movie that I'm talking about. I haven't made a movie that's as good as that one that I love, you know, that's like sort of like my movies I love. I'm so proud of them. And they're doing a thing that The Conjuring's not doing. But The Conjuring's doing a thing that's really cool and fun.
Yeah.
And it's very, very exciting for me to maybe also do that thing.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
the other thing that's exciting to me is I don't know that I'm good at that thing, but it would be fun to get good at that thing just because it's another like skill set to like tuck in your toolbox. You
well,
know?
But I think and, like, the thing you have going for you is a confidence in... at the very least editing and at the very least getting amazing performances out of people and also the capacity to collaborate.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the way that I look at the work that I've done with actors is like not getting amazing performances out of people. It's allowing people to give amazing performances. Like they've got the stuff, right? And like as long like I'm good at getting out of the way
yeah.
and letting the stuff just shine through.
Well, a lot of times you're acting.
Yeah. That's right.
You're good at that.
Well, thanks, man. I like doing it. It's fun for me.
I hope you can keep this disposition. I want to talk to you in 2 years just to see if like if anything is
yeah.
sort of like
what could happen. What do you
falling.
Think could happen?
What do I think could happen?
I could die a little bit inside, or what do you mean?
Well, I mean, I think that's a trope. I think what happens is you have to negotiate.
Yeah.
And you have to negotiate vision sometimes.
Yeah.
Even if it's not because of power reasons, you know, it might be the right thing to do. And I think having never had an experience with that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you die inside, but I think it's a painful process.
Yeah.
And
what can you be more specific? Like, it sounds like what you're saying is it's a painful process to acknowledge that somebody else might be right or more right than you are.
Yeah. And also that you might have to, you know, not do it exactly the way that you wanted to do.
Yes,
it.
Totally.
And that, you know, there are actually people that might know better.
Totally.
And
this sounds very exciting. This kind of pain sounds very exciting to me, though,
good,
actually.
Good,
like,
good.
If I can do that with smart people who actually are right, it sounds most painful if they're wrong and you have to compromise and then it doesn't work.
Right.
And that sounds very painful to me, where it's like, fuck, I trusted you and you fucked me. And now the movie's bad because I listened to you or
well,
because also, you had the power to just do it.
Well, that happens. See, that's the other part of it, is that when there's larger stakes
yeah.
and there's more power involved,
yeah.
then, you know, you're going to be the guy that gets thrown under the bus.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it all gets tricky.
Yeah.
But I think what you've done for yourself ultimately and your real passion is to make films the way you want to make them and to experience the organic connection of the process and the event itself outside of the movie, you know, has as much significance
yeah
to you
yeah
so like the weird thing about that is that you know if you get beat up a little bit you can just go back and make your movies.
That's how I feel about it. Yeah. That's why I'm even entertaining the idea.
Well, believe me, like I know whatever's going on for me now that at the end yeah. of the day I can come do this.
Yeah, right. It's
just
great
in my garage
it?
To talk to you.
Tell me about it, man.
But
it's
you know,
very nice to have that.
Yeah, you just don't want to get heartbroken. That's I think that, you know, and there's no way to avoid it. But yeah, I think that if you have a good head on your shoulders and you have things in perspective, which you seem to have, you know, you can, you know.
Yeah, man.
You can kind of relegate the risk, you know. It's
yeah.
not like anyone's going to ask you to direct a superhero
That's
movie.
Right. That's right.
Not yet.
Yeah, not yet, nor do I want to. So like, everything right now is pretty cool. Like, the stuff that I'm reading that's written by other people that could be bigger movies isn't superhero stuff. It's mostly like the smartest, cool stuff. I mean, George Clooney has consistently made really good, smart movies. I mean, he doesn't yeah. seem to fuck around and just like do dumb shit.
Yeah.
They're almost all good.
Yeah. And he seems like a pretty good guy. You can talk to Anna about him. He seems like a great guy.
Yeah.
It's a good
she
movie
had a
star.
Really good experience working
yeah,
with him.
Yeah, man.
Definitely.
Yeah. So did Danny McBride, you know, like these guys.
Yeah.
So you come out here to LA and, you know, why would you come to LA? What's happening?
Well, I come to L.A. because I have business out here now. You know, like I come out here to work. I actually live in Chicago to like live.
You're in the movie business.
I am in the movie business. I yeah. actually am like, I make a living from my movies. And so I come out here to work.
How do you make a living from your movies?
Well, it's come in various channels. My earlier movies are starting to bring me some money now because they are getting distribution in other countries. You know, some of them are 7 and 8 years old, but if the Sundance Channel, you know, like had success with Drinking Buddies, then they're like, oh, this guy has other movies we've never aired on the Sundance Channel. Let's license these for a small amount of money. So that stuff is like from the old stuff's kind of starting to trickle in. And then I am developing a movie for Fox Searchlight. So I got paid money to write that, which is part of how I'm living right now. And then I make money when I sell my movies.
So is that a movie on your terms for Fox Searchlight?
Definitely. I pitched them an idea and they liked it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And do you hang out with the other young guns, like the Duplass boys? And
I see them sometimes. I'm...
They're taking over Hollywood.
They definitely are. I mean, it's amazing. Without knowing it, have been incredibly helpful to me.
How so?
Because my stuff doesn't seem as crazy in a world where the Duplass brothers are really successful. And so they paved a way in the industry during the years where I was so resistant to the industry. They were out here making these kinds of movies in the studio system, and now the studio system has context for these kinds of movies. And so, you know, when a movie like Drinking Buddies got seen by more people than we expected, it was a lot easier for me to come out here and say, this is the next thing I want to make, and to have agents want their actors to do it, to have distributors want to buy it and release it. And, you know, to a certain extent, Lena Dunham's done that too. I mean, like,
oh, that's right. She was in Happy Christmas.
She acted in Happy Christmas. And like, she and the Duplass brothers, I would say, you know, have sort of been the biggest advocates for stuff outside the system. You know, even though like they're known now for making stuff within the system, they've given context for the weirder stuff. And so, like, in a world where Girls is on TV and where Jeff Who Lives at Home opens in regular movie theaters, my stuff seems a little less weird, and that's oddly a big difference in the last couple of years.
It's interesting because like it's almost a return to, you know, like for years, you know, even when you talk about like you know, David O. Russell or what, you know, or where Scorsese came from, that the sort of highbrow kind of you know, intellectual discussion around anything, you know, film wise or art wise, became very insulated and kind of old guardish.
Yeah.
And I think that with people like you and with people like Lena, who I've talked to, and Duplass, when he feels like talking about that, you know, and about, you know, what his place is and why the films he made were important, that it's sort of coming back. Like there's a little more movement towards, you know, an actual kind of intellectual discussion about art and about what film is capable of.
Yeah.
And also I think that the business is broken open enough that really everybody can find their niche and in a way, especially if you've got talent and you've got friends and you're part of a momentum, you know, that justifies you, you know?
Yeah. And also we, even in my life, I've seen it go through waves and, you know, we happen to be in a wave right now where the studio system is, let's see, as risk-averse as I've ever seen it in my life, right? Like, they're only making movies that make complete sense and are almost guaranteed to succeed.
Internationally.
Yeah, for sure. It's a global industry now.
Which means it's the bar is low.
The bar is low, but the bar is complicated. It's like a low bar that has a lot of twists and turns in it, and they know how to navigate that geniusly. But like I, for instance,
they're
can't
making
even
amusement
start to
park
think
rides.
About it.
They're making amusement park rides.
I mean, on the bigger scale, they certainly are, definitely. Right. And as somebody who likes to go to amusement parks, I also like to go to their amusement park rides as often as I like to go to indie films. You know, it's like it's actually really fun for me to put on the 3D glasses and like drink a large sugary drink and like fucking kick back for 2 hours. I dig it. And so, you know, there's that thing happening. And I think that what I've noticed happening is that that pool of actors that can do those kinds of movies is pretty small.
Yeah.
And unless you get absorbed up into it, you know, you're kind of left these days if you're a really talented actor with then like sort of slim pickings on like the other kind of stuff that they're making. And what that has done for me is meant that a lot of really, really talented people have been willing to come out and do a small weird
movie. Great.
It's great.
Yeah.
It makes me very excited. It makes me feel like we're almost about to be in a really cool period of movies.
Yeah.
Where suddenly it's like, oh, holy shit. There was 15 great movies that came out this year.
Yes.
With great performances, like classic, amazing performances.
Yeah.
And it's because those people didn't get cast in the comic book movies that year. And they have enough money that they don't need to go to a job.
And they want to
work. And so they went and did something cool.
Yeah, they want to do, they want to act.
Yeah.
Are you ever going to do like a large ensemble piece like an Altman movie?
My new one is like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie Digging for Fire that I'm finishing right now. Uh-huh. It's, there are new characters showing up all the way through the last couple minutes of the movie. Like just, it's a sprawling sort of L.A. movie with a lot of people,
you shot it
a
here?
Lot of roles. I did shoot it here, and we shot it on 35mm.
Really?
I shot on film again, yeah.
Who funded that?
I did, partially, and then this group of Chicago investors that I work with, and then Jake Johnson, the lead actor.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, shit, man. I wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you. I'll take it.
And I got to catch up with more of your movies, but I think we did all right with the knowledge I had.
I'm surprised you've seen as many as you've seen.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I love them.
Thanks, man.
Like, I'm telling people about them.
That's really cool. That's nice. I like them, too. But, you know, it's like getting older. I'm just like more every day. It's more and more clear why other people don't. I'm like, I get why it's not, or it's not what you're looking for.
Yeah, but
I used to, when I was young, I was so frustrated. But I was like, why don't you like it, man? It's like, I'm trying these things. How can you not engage? Now that I'm a little older, I'm like, some days you're in the mood for it. Some days you just want something easy. Like, I get it.
That's right. And I've had to feel that way about my stand-up and stuff. It's like, I can't, I never set out to make everybody happy.
That's right.
Like, you can't do it.
Totally.
But if enough people are into it, it's sort of like, well, then I'm going to keep doing it. Because you're up against that the meaning thing and the fear of dying thing.
Yeah.
That there's some part of you that's always going to think like, well, I have to make the thing that impacts the world.
Yeah.
You know? And who's going to do that? I'm not Beyonce.
It's an awful lot of pressure.
It's an awful lot of pressure, but it's an awful lot of compromise in a way.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, because once you do that, then you're sort of like, boy, I hope he does it again.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I got to do it again.
Yeah.
And then, like, if you don't do it again, you're like, you failed the world.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't come see you in Sweden.
Yeah.
But you probably do all right in Sweden. Thanks for talking to me, man.
Yeah.
Great guy, right?
I love that guy, and I love his movies. That was Joe Swanberg. Hope you dug that. I'm coming to you, if you forgot, from a hotel room in Rochester, New York. And I'm fine. I'm fine. I've got a crate of mandarin oranges, and I'm eating them thinking that they will change something. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Pick up the app. Get on the mailing list. Leave a comment if you want. We're going to have some new merch coming. Marination tour dates are up at WTFpod/calendar. Everything's looking good. I'm excited to get out there. These warm-up shows are going well. what else can I tell you? Yeah, so the Tripany House shows at the in Los Angeles at the Steve Allen Theater on March 31st. That's a Tuesday. And April 6th, that's a Monday. If you want to get in on that. What else? I hope I get better soon. I like being, there's something about being sick that's relaxing. And there's something I enjoy about hearing my voice like this, but my brain is not as good as it should be when it's sick. I mean, it's always a little sick, but not like sick from congestion. I hope you feel good. Okay? All right.
Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.